Who has ever heard Kol Nidre gushing from the breast of man? Rising, falling, as the ocean lifts the waves in joy or fear. From time's ocean has it risen. Every age has lent a murmur. Every cycle built a wall. 'Tis the voice of countless pilgrims answering in thousand voices, fate and destiny of man. 'Tis a saintly aspiration of a holy soul in prayer. 'Tis the music hummed by mercy when the heart is touched by love. 'Tis the welding of all mercy, love, forgiveness in a union, sweeping o'er the span of ages. Hark the strains of deep Kol Nidre, saddest music ever mortal taught his lips to hymn or sound. To the Jew, any promises which crossed his lips were considered sacred vows. Sometimes these promises were made to man, at other times to God. Sometimes they were made properly. At other times they were made under duress and could not be fulfilled. But to the Jew, every promise was sacred and real. Once each year, the Jew would stand before God on the eve of Yom Kippur and pray to be forgiven for the vows and promises he had been unable to keep. There thus grew up the custom of Kol Nidre. The music we hear now is many hundreds of years old. It is the Kol Nidre melody, which is being sung by Jews throughout the world on this most sacred night. It is a stirring melody, yet solemn and soft. It makes us kin with Jews the world over. As we listen now, we are carried back to a scene which took place centuries ago among the Jews of Spain. We find ourselves in a dark cellar. The lights are low. A feeling of fear pervades the atmosphere. People are stealing in as though running away from some inescapable disaster, as though evading an unrelenting pursuer. They glance furtively over their shoulders. They sigh with relief when they realize that for the moment, at least, they are safe. Many of these Jews have been forced by the Inquisition to accept Christianity, but in their hearts they remain Jewish. Secretly, in their homes, in cellars, in caves, they pray to the God of Israel. Once each year, they assemble in some hidden synagogue to ask God's forgiveness for the many vows they have taken during the year. Fervently, they pray, Kol Nidre, all my vows that I have made to thee, know, O God, that I made them because of compulsion. But deep within my heart, I have always been faithful to Israel. In the year to come, I may again be compelled to make false vows of disloyalty to Judaism. Therefore, I pray that Kol Nidre, all such vows for the coming year, be considered meaningless and void. These Jews huddle together like hunted animals, fearful lest they be discovered. There is a murmur of many voices as they unite in prayer. With broken hearts, they weep bitterly. As the elders stand and mount the pulpit, the congregation rises. A profound silence reigns. The ark is opened. The Torahs are removed and held before the people. And then, out of the silence and darkness, the sorrowful voice of the cantor begins the chant.
Yesorei, Vacharomei, Vekonomei, Vechinuyei, Vekinusei, Ushvu.
Solo,
Dear friends, the topic of tonight's sermon could have surprised no one. After all, the word sin is part of the very lexicon of this day. What then could be more natural than for a rabbi to speak at this time and in this place on the subject, the most dangerous sin? I would venture an immediate guess, however, that though the question posed as my topic tonight caused no surprise, the answer I am about to propose may very well have that effect. I do not intend, good friends, in these next minutes to talk to you about any lurid offenses such as murder or massacre or rape or even the most monstrous of all modern immoralities, the waging of war. I intend instead to talk to you just as directly and bluntly as I know how about a far less spectacular sin than these, one which, precisely because of its inconspicuousness, makes these others possible, namely the sin of moral neutrality. Without any further explanation or introduction, then, allow me, if you will, please, to turn at once to what I believe to be the two most frequent forms of moral neutrality in our civilization today. The first of these is the theory of ethical relativism. The notion that there are no objective standards or criteria by which right can be distinguished from wrong. The most we can say is that societies in various parts of the world differ in their ethical tastes. The responsibility of the individual, then, according to this view, is simply to conform to the moral fashion of the society in which he lives, not to seek earnestly for universal ethical truths which don't exist. While this sort of opinion comes to me most frequently, I must confess, in my conversations with college students, I hear it also with sufficient frequency from their elders to cause me no little disturbance. Usually, the protagonists of such opinions reminds me somewhere along the line about the Eskimos, who believe that it is ethically correct to do away with their elders when they have reached a certain advanced age. While we, of course, in our society, try to provide our elders with the best possible medical attention and care. The implication, of course, is that neither attitude can be considered ethically superior to the other. Each is acceptable and satisfactory for the society in which it appears. Now, no one who is at all acquainted with the facts would seek to deny for a moment that, of course, there are elements of relativity and subjectivity in our pursuit of ethics. We touched on this, many of you will remember, just 10 days ago on Rosh Hashanah, in observing that sometimes it becomes necessary to hold one ethical ideal temporarily in abeyance for the purpose of achieving another ideal, which in that circumstance and setting seems to be the more pressing. So, of course, there are elements of relativity involved in the pursuit of ethics. But to broaden these valid elements into a generalized assertion that all ethical ideals are subjective, and that therefore no ethical standard can be considered superior to any other, is, allow me to suggest, to compound our confusion and to seek cheap, easy excuses for our deficiencies. How true this is will immediately become apparent, I believe, by way of analogy. Consider with me for a moment, will you not, that there are also vast differences among social groups in their understanding of scientific fact. There are societies in the remote corners of civilization which still believe to this day that the earth is flat, or that certain magic rites are necessary to coax the sun into continued shining. Now, surely all of us understand the fact that there are human beings who believe these things to be true certainly does not make them true. It simply demonstrates that there are some human groups and societies that have advanced farther in this respect than have others, and which are therefore better able realistically to comprehend certain observable and demonstrable facts. Perhaps another analogy will be helpful from the area of aesthetics. Here, certainly, subjective elements must be considered. One human being may prefer the music of Beethoven to that of Mozart, or the poetry of Wordsworth to that of Keats, while his neighbor may reverse the preference in both respects without either of them necessarily being right or wrong. But if one were to assert that the music of Elvis Presley is superior to that either of Beethoven or Mozart, or the poetry of Edgar Guest more beautiful than that of Wordsworth or Keats, then, permit me to suggest, we're no longer dealing with just a simple subjective preference, This then becomes a matter of aesthetic illiteracy. To be sure, the aborigine in the jungle is not to be blamed if he prefers the rhythm beat of the tom-tom to superb symphony. But neither can we have the right to pretend, therefore, that there is no objective basis on which to distinguish one from the other. Do I make myself and my position clear? In science and in aesthetics, we admit the legitimacy of subjective preferences while at the same time recognizing the existence of objective standards. Exactly the same thing must be true in ethics. Here, too, there are individuals and groups which, through the course of the centuries, have reached a higher level of attainment and perfection than have other groups. And those of us who are privileged to partake of the benefits of such higher civilization, to enjoy its many advantages and conveniences and comforts, must be prepared also to assume the greater measure of ethical responsibility this brings us. There isn't time in this context, I'm sorry to say, for a complete or extended discussion of just what the objective standards are which ought to govern the ethical lives of all human beings. Allow me, therefore, merely to suggest as a kind of rubric for later elaboration the following. Whatever in a given setting or circumstance helps the individual man or woman to grow, whatever assists him in the fulfillment of his highest human potential, whatever maximizes his freedom along with that of his fellow, whatever encourages him to develop and express his human margin of superiority over all other known forms of life, is ethically good. Whatever restricts or inhibits or constrains him in these respects is ethically evil. Here, I submit, are criteria which can apply to all men at all times in all places. Here are criteria which are objective and universal, and which I think ought to dispense once and for all with the foolish nonsense that all ethics are subjective and relative. The second form of moral neutrality to be found with alarming frequency in our civilization is the idea that it is possible to be ethically indifferent without causing any harm. That there are, one might say, three basic ethical positions corresponding to the three alternatives in shifting the gears of an automobile: forward, reverse, and neutral. If one is not moving either forward or backward, it may then be safely presumed that he is just standing still. Now, this is obviously true with reference to an automobile. It is a hopeless delusion with reference to ethical conduct. So long as a human being remains conscious and alive, actually, he faces but two possible ethical alternatives. He moves either in one direction or the other. There is no standing still. He who, in a given circumstance, ethically speaking, is not moving forward toward ethical improvement, is thereby of necessity and automatically moving backward toward ethical regression. It is no more possible to stand still morally than it is for the pilot of a plane to remain motionless in midair. In one case as in the other, we move forward or we crash. I remember very well the exact circumstance in which this truth was impressed upon my mind most indelibly. It was on the ship which brought me back from combat on Iwo Jima to rehabilitation on the island of Hawaii. I suppose the indescribably horrible experience through which I had just lived had something to do with increasing my aesthetic and ethical sensitivity to a novel that I read on board ship en route back from hell to earth. It was called The Cross and the Arrow. It told the story of an ordinary, average German in the 1930s, who, as a matter of fact, was revolted and disgusted by much of what he saw the Nazis doing